I'm going to start off my talk with a quote that won't have much to do with most of the talk, but anyway, it's from the great folk singer and anarchist Utah Phillips, and he once said, "I can go outside and pick up a rock that's older than the oldest song you know, and bring it in here and drop it on your foot." He said, "Now the past didn't go anywhere, did it?" So what I'd like to talk about today, kind of as a background to my talk today, is the idea that when we're talking about Earth systems, particularly Earth's surface systems, the past is always a factor in terms of the dynamics of that system. And so if I get to it at the end, I'll try and bring that theme back into what I talk about, but that's something you might think about as I'm talking. So what I'm going to talk about today is something that I'm actually not working actively on, but at the moment, but I had a lot of fun working on, and I think connects the sort of things that I work on pretty well with the theme of granular dynamics. And so what you're looking at here is something that's called a sorted pattern ground. You're looking at a couple of examples of it. This is in Spitsbergen, which is an island archipelago north of Norway. And these things are known as sorted circles. They're raised rings of stones which surround areas that are pretty devoid of stones. They're just soil, fine-grained soil. And they're typically 1 to 3 or 4 meters across in diameter. They form pretty interesting patterns. You typically have these lone circles, or sometimes they kind of are merging together, as you see here. So that's one form of sorted pattern ground. Another is known as sorted polygons, and that's shown here. This is from Central Alaska, a picture taken from a kite. These are polygons. They're a couple meters across. They're in a dried-out pond. And you can see these patterns here. They kind of grade into this mess over here, and then up here, they grade into isolated just mounds of stones, or what we call stone islands. So you can see that there's kind of a variety of patterns. These things occur primarily in the polar regions. Basically, they occur where, typically where the ground is underlain by permafrost, not always. And so this is a map of permafrost in the northern hemisphere. Up here is kind of continuous regions of permafrost. Down here is less continuous permafrost. But basically, permafrost is permanently frozen ground. And I've circled here sites that we've looked at in Alaska and Spitsbergen, which is where most of the pictures I'll be showing you come from. So permafrost basically forms the backdrop for these patterns. They're not very common. They're not really important in any real landscape sense or societal sense. They're just kind of neat patterns. But I guess you're not supposed to tell that to your funding agents. Anyway, so just to give a little bit more context, the Arctic and subarctic, which comprises about a third of the Earth's land surface, is host to a lot of different patterns and features, most of which are associated with permafrost in some way or another. Now, I've just shown some pictures here just to give you some idea of the variety of patterns you see. Just note these things are ice wedge networks, which are wedges of ice that form in ground as the ground cracks as it cools. These are patterns of thaw lakes and drained thaw lake basins. This is the primary way that permafrost is melted. And it's a lot of interest now as the climate warms, because there's kind of a fear that a lot of the permafrost that I was showing you in the last picture is going to melt in a fairly short period of time, at least the near surface permafrost. And that's a reservoir for a lot of undecayed organics. Basically that could be released as carbon into the atmosphere if they were unfrozen. This is just some other patterns you see in the northern regions. These patterns are patterns in vegetation. These are string bogs, which are areas which are dominated by sphagnum moss that likes to grow a little bit above the water, and once it does very well. Here's just some patterns of trees near the tree line, and some patterns of birch and spruce on hill slopes. So basically, this region is host to a whole range of patterns, and the sorted pattern gram is just one example. One other thing I just want to mention, just as something that I work on a lot these days, is how humans and landscapes interact, the patterns that are associated with that. And I've just illustrated some patterns here. These are barrier islands, which are islands which form on coastlines that have too much sand. And they're host to a lot of really nice resorts. And those resorts protect the islands and basically alter the dynamics of those islands and their response to storms. Here I've shown you urban areas abutting up against mountain catchments, and basically there's an interesting dynamics that's associated with the interface between the urban areas and the wildlands. So that's just kind of a background for, I'm sorry. So this is basically just a thermal image, and I'm actually not sure exactly what those colors represent, but it's basically giving you these red areas are kind of urbanized areas, and these urbanized and burned areas, and these are unburned vegetation. So to return to sorted pattern ground then, here I've just shown you some of the variety of patterns you see. And before I go any further, I forgot to mention that what I'm showing you here is really, I did it in collaboration with a couple of colleagues, Brad Murray at Duke University and Bernard Hillet at the University of Washington. But it's actually the thesis project of Mark Kessler, who did all the work. So I'm more or less just telling you what he did. This just kind of gives you an indication, again, of the variety of patterns you can see. The sorted circles I talked about earlier. In association with these sorted circles, you often see what we call sorted mazes, where here is the fine-grained soil, the stony areas, but instead of being formed into circles, they kind of have these lobate things sticking out and form into nice little mazes. If you put a hill slope on this stuff, it forms itself into downslope trending stripes. And in areas, this typically occurs in areas that are a bit drier and also have larger stones. Instead of forming circles, the pattern forms itself into polygons, which are these are lines of stones, fairly straight lines of stones, surrounding polygonal areas of stone-free soil. So what's, I guess the big question is, like, what are the processes that are giving rise to these patterns? And to do that, we can just, it's actually turns out that it's not very complicated, but we can just look then at a cross section of the soil in these areas where these sorted pattern ground forms. So in areas where you have permafrost, permanently frozen ground, so that's ground that doesn't thaw during the summer, it can be up to 1.5 kilometers thick, typically a lot less. But during the summer, it gets pretty warm in the Arctic and sunny almost all day. And a thin layer at the surface melts during the summer. And that layer that melts, this is basically how far the melting front goes at the end of the summer, is called the active layer. And it's usually about 0.5 meters to 1 meter thick. It varies from place to place. And it's called the active layer for a very good reason, because of the processes which occur in it. I'm just going to describe them briefly here. The critical process for our purposes, there are actually a lot of things going on, is basically not so much what happens when this layer thaws in the summer, but what happens when it freezes up in the fall. So basically, what happens when it freezes up in the fall is the air temperature is below freezing, below zero, and then it basically it kind of forms a freezing front then, which penetrates into the soil, and that freezing front defines the line where that demarcates between the area that's above freezing and below freezing in temperature. So as the freezing front begins to move into the soil, these soils are typically fairly wet. Permafrost is really impermeable to water, so any water, any rain or whatever that that falls and doesn't evaporate, it's pretty cold, so not much evaporation, that water just sits in the soil. So these soils are pretty wet. There's a lot of water. So as the freezing front starts moving into the soil, it begins to freeze the water. As the water freezes, it releases latent heat, so it's it basically keeps the freezing front stationary at that position until all the water there is frozen. But what happens is water likes to do two things. It likes to sit on soil particles rather than just being around other water, but it even likes more to sit on the surface of ice. And so if you begin to form then a little pod of ice here, as this freezing front is descending into the soil, it will draw water up from below because of chemical gradients that just draw it right up to that surface. And so instead of just freezing the water that's there within the pores of the soil, it actually draws water up and creates a little pod of ice that we call ice lenses. Then it basically just continues drawing up water until this area below the ice lens is desiccated. Then the freezing front, once it's done freezing, can move fairly rapidly through that desiccated area and go down to, again, saturated soil and start the process again. So what you see when you look at these soils when they're frozen is just kind of layer on layer on layer of these ice lenses. It depends on a lot of things. It depends a little bit on the temperature gradient. It depends on the characteristics of the soil, how easy it is for the water to migrate up along the surface through the pores of the soil. So it's kind of a complicated thing that isn't actually very understood very well.
But this is an unconsolidated soil phenomenon.
It's actually fairly this the soil for these sorted circles is fairly mucky during the summer. It's basically the, if you just look at, I mean, I'm not an expert on this topic, but if you look at the, the chemical potential of water just sitting on a surface of soil or sitting in a droplet of water versus sitting on the surface of ice.
So the way I would describe this is that it's a capillary-driven phase separation, where you take an unconsolidated soil with water, and then as the water freezes, the water tends to separate into these ice lenses, and there'll be a flux of soil away. That's my understanding of what you just said.
Right. I mean, but there is a. It isn't just. It isn't a surface tension phenomenon, but it's really a surface. It's not the water surface that's important, it's the ice surface that's important.
But the ice is probably less salty than the inside the earth.
It's not the concentration gradient, it's a different situation. And total chemical potential in one phase versus the other, rather than the classical diagram, which really matters.
Yeah. I think you all know more about this than I do, but. But that's basically what happens. And so the effect of that is actually very important, though. Kind of almost regardless of how it happens, the effect is really important. Because now you're taking water from the pores within the soil and you're concentrating it in these ice lenses. And so the only way that can happen is if the total volume within the soil increases. And so what it does is it causes a heaving of the soil, usually by about 10 to 20% of the total thickness of the active layer throughout the entire freezing process. So it's heaving up the surface, and it's also pushing down on the soil below. So it's consolidating and compressing the soil below the freezing front as well. So that you see those two processes going on. And that's why it's called the active layers, because you have a lot of things going on. This isn't a totally even process, it's a little bit heterogeneous. And so there's just a lot of mixing of the active layer in this process.
Absorption by rocks and by the lake soils, the difference between absorption does not stay in the walls?
You mean in the surface? It's not a. You're right. I mean, there are slight temperature differences between these two, but that's not the biggest effect. And I actually haven't told you what the biggest effect is. The biggest effect between these soil-rich, stone-rich areas and the soil-rich areas is that basically what I just described here doesn't happen when you have big stones, because you don't have the opportunity to draw the water up and create these ice lenses with these large pores in the stone domain. So that's kind of, as I think I show in the next slide, that's kind of the fundamental difference then.
So it has nothing to do with the absorption of energy at the surface. What it has to do is that depending on whether you have fine or coarse-grained soil, you are able in the available time to form the ice lenses or not.
Yes, that's correct. So basically what happens is there's, you know, in this stone domain, there might be a little bit of water sitting down here at the bottom, but basically the freezing front just kind of motors right through this stone domain until it gets down there and just freezes that water in place. Whereas here in the soil domain, the entire soil column is fairly saturated with water, and so you're creating these ice lenses right from the get-go. So basically, what's happening then in terms of like how do you get a lateral separation between stones and soil, which is kind of the fundamental aspect of the pattern, is if you have some initial difference between these two things, then you'll have an inclined freezing front at the interface. And in terms of this soil compaction, that will tend to drive soil towards the center of the soil domain. So it's a separation process, as well as the heave creating a surface on which any stones that are sitting up here will ravel down to the stone domain. So that's the basic feedback, at least, that we're proposing for how these things might form. And then you can ask the question, well, if you try to incorporate that feedback into a model, do you get forms that look like sorted circles?
Is this behavior specific to permafrost?
What I'm describing here also occurs in areas where you don't have permafrost. When you don't have permafrost, there are some additional complications that make this less likely to happen. For example, the permafrost basically forms an impermeable barrier below the active layer, and so that tends to promote saturation of the soil, which is really important for the formation of these ice lenses.
I mean, you said that the freezing front attracts the water from below. Why doesn't the frozen layer on the ground, the permafrost,
That's a really good question. The part of the driving mechanism for this is a temperature gradient, and the temperature gradient down here at the bottom is really low. So I believe that's the answer to your question, although I'm not totally sure.
There might be a drift of the grains, of the small grains, due to the fact that you have a gradient inside. Then if you have a drift, you can bring the big balls at the edge, and then they stay there.
I'm talking about the water going up and going down. Why does water go up and not down?
It's frozen. Yeah, but it's frozen. So it cannot be...
When you mentioned temperature gradient, it reminds me of T.G. Snow, the temperature gradient snow, where you have an evaporation of the water from one grain, and that deposits into another grain, and there the mechanism is to do with the greater sort of curvature of the grain, you know, that if the radius of curvature is very small,
right, yeah,
they accumulate there more and stuff like that. And so that's the formation. Does this phenomenon have anything to do with it?
Well, I mean, one thing that's happening is that when you have the freezing front going down here, everything above here is frozen and it's fairly rigid and somewhat impermeable to any sort of evaporative processes. So I think it might not be.
Well, there's no water involved. I mean, there's no liquid water involved. It's also cremation from the solid.
It's sublimation, I see. Okay. So you could potentially get it into, although this is a pretty saturated soil. I don't know for sure.
I mean, below the freezing front, you have pretty completely saturated soil.
Yes. Except as it gets desiccated below, right below the ice lenses.
I mean, maybe you're going to tell me this, but it disturbs me that I'm not already able to guess where the 1 meter comes from.
That's like a totally separate question. It has to do with, it has to do with temperature gradients, even the geothermal gradient, the temperature gradient, the remnant temperature gradient.
And by the depth of the region that thaws.
Absolutely.
1 meter is some number what the depth of the region that thaws.
In the summer, right. And so it varies from with summertime temperature. And
it has nothing to do with the size of the ice lands or anything like that.
Only peripherally, yeah. It does have to do with something to do with the insulation properties of the soil.
If this process is going for more than 6 months or less, would that length be changed?
Which length scale? The depth of the active layer? Are you talking about laterally or? I'll talk about a little bit about the length scale of the circles in a minute. But I think it would be easier to talk about it then. So let me just kind of rocket beyond these processes and just talk about a model, because in some sense, I guess from my perspective, the interesting aspect of these patterns are the pattern dynamics. So this is just a three-dimensional model that Mark Hessler developed. It's a three-dimensional cellular model, four types of cells: stones, soil, ice, and voids to allow soil compressibility. And the basic idea behind the model is to start with an initial non-pattern state, freeze up the active layer, then thaw it, and then if there's anything that happens when the layer is thawed, we do that. And then just keep doing that year after year. So this is just, I'm just going to go through this really quickly, but this is just the processes that I've been talking about, plus a few others added in. In the freezing, basically he solves a heat conduction equation with including latent heat from freezing. He calculates frost heat by putting in cells that that are ice, and then either pushing the stone or soil that was at that location up towards the surface, or down towards a void, basically just kind of based on distance. So you get frost heat and soil compaction and the surface uplift from the frost heat. As he's thawing his simulation space, as the top of it thaws, you get surface creep along the surface. Basically, if there's a slope, things will move downhill. You get something that's called alluviation, which basically means that if somehow you inject some soil into these stony areas, the soil tends to kind of percolate down to the bottom. You get as the thing is thawing, the soil consolidates, but then as the meltwater percolates down through the soil, it inflates again, it expands, and so he does he simulates that by creating voids. Yeah.
When it's freezing, is the air temperature less than the permafrost, or is it greater? I think this is important for the mechanism that is good.
Yeah. Basically, this temperature is set at zero, which is basically its mean annual temperature. Celsius, yeah. And then this temperature up here is set as it's freezing to a lower temperature. I believe it's -5. Oh, really? Okay. Okay. Maybe we can talk about that. About that afterwards.
The density of the soil in the stony area What's more dense?
You mean in terms of like, yeah. So we're not actually calculating in any dynamical forces, and so we're not including density effects in the simulation. They're actually, the density effects have been estimated in and found to be pretty small. But I couldn't quote you a number.
The freezing of the surface of the snow in mountains, either the air temperature is larger than 0 degrees Celsius, because there is the diffusion of the cold coming from the lower layer of the snow.
Yeah.
So I would expect that the winds profile for the temperature, because to my opinion, due to the permafrost, the soil and noticeably the night should be colder, constantly colder than the air.
So when this is freezing, the permafrost down here is at zero.
Why?
Because that's we're setting it to its mean annual temperature, which is exactly zero. The top of the permafrost layer.
And that's a definition.
Yeah, exactly. That's basically a definition. And so, sorry? Yeah, there's not...
The heat fluxes to permafrost are much less.
Thank you, Thomas. Yeah. The heat fluxes are less up and down. So, this is the nature. This is an output of the model, just doing what I just told you about. We get things that are about, that are pretty similar to what we see in size. They take about 500 years to form in our simulation. And let me, unfortunately, I'm using like a open source version of Office, and I can't figure out how to do an animation in it, but let me just show you quickly an animation of this thing forming. We start with a layer of stones overlying soil, which is a typical thing you see in the field, and then you see basically plugs of soil, instabilities developing in that layer, and then plugs of soil moving up to the surface and pushing out a ring of stones around the soil plug.
You can tell you why the stone is above, because in your little model, you got the stone below and the soil was rising above. Now you put the view of the same position.
Let's see. In
the pressure of the land, because you always have the stones down and the plug is pushed out. And with some
It sort of matters how much pushing there is of due to frost heave basically from the soil into the stones, and so you can get a variety of elevations of the stone.
Presumably, if you went back to Bergen in the winter, which I would certainly recommend you do, you would see a different. I mean, you'd see the heave and the relief would look different.
You'd have to do some shoveling, but yeah. Yeah, and that's exactly right. Is these things in the this picture is actually showing a thawed state through time, but definitely during the winter, these things do inflate up. So,
are these things? Can these things be seen in
I don't know of any instance of them being seen in an outcrop. But I don't know for sure. I've never heard of one. That would be really cool.
And the question is whether they can be preserved. I mean, so if you rise sea level and you cover this all with a clay or something, then, you know, could you go back later and find it?
Yeah, I mean, that would have to be that would have to be a scenario like that, for sure. So this is just kind of repeating what I just showed you, but as I said, kind of the key thing is you have this layer between the stones and soil, the initial condition, and it's unstable. And question is, why is it unstable? Which I'll come back to in a second. But first let me show you a cross-section of the model and just ask what are kind of the patterns of motion of stones and soil within sorted circles. So this is that stone domain, that soil plug. I'm sorry, the soil plug. And these are the stone rings on each side.
You need the middle for the soil.
Sorry?
You need the geological middle for the soil to compute that.
We're basically moving soil around. As we're freezing, we're putting in these cubes of ice, which are what we use for...
There's a preservation rule then. Conservation rule of
volume. Yeah, yeah. That's basically... And so we have rules for pushing the soil around, and that's what results in this. This is an averaged over, I believe, 500 years, and maybe it's 750 years. And basically, what you see is that the soil is moving up in the center along the surface and then down at the interface in a circulation pattern, which goes for about 750 years in our simulation. If you look in it's kind of hard to get these kind of data in the field, especially for 750 years, but you can go put markers on the surface of the soil domain and the stone domain and watch how they change. And that's been done. And those data are shown here. This is the center of the circle, applying the radial velocity versus the radial coordinate. The center of the circle going out, here's the interface between the soil domain and the stone domain. And so you can see that the radial velocity outward goes up and then reaches a maximum of about 30 centimeters from the interface and then goes down to zero at the interface. These are model results, averaged model results. We're kind of in the right ballpark. The maximum of almost a centimeter per year. We're kind of in the right ballpark, a little bit high, but we do kind of reproduce that basic pattern. And so, at least to the extent we can do it, we can test the model quantitatively.
What would be the dimensions numbers that you would write? Actual scales?
Yeah, I'll talk about that in a minute, what like scales the size. So basically, I talked about this instability of the interface between the stones, the overlying stones, and the soil that leads to the development of the soil plug. And you can basically write down, this is my one equation, you can write down a equation that says how, within the model, how the height of a soil column varies through time. And it varies in two ways. Basically, as I said near the beginning, the soil is being compacted as the ice lenses grow. And because of the inclination in the freezing front, that compaction process is moving soil laterally. And so what we can say is that the way that the height grows is through transport of soil from ice lenses growing in adjacent areas into the voids or the effective compressibility within your soil column. So we have kind of a positive contribution, which is proportional to the height of the soil column. So if there's more soil, it's more, you can compress it more. Then that soil column loses soil by basically growing ice lenses and transporting them into adjoining regions. And basically this expression here is more or less telling you how we determine which void we push the soil towards in our model when we're creating an ice lens, creating an ice cube. And basically what we do is we kind of use a probability that scales with the distance. So if a void is closer, it's more probable that we'll create an ice lens and push towards it. That scaling has a parameter associated with it, a distance, which is actually the distance that scales this part of the dynamics. So basically, we add soil and subtract soil, and then you can just ask the question, well, if I linearize this, what's the fastest growing wavelength? And these two lines here basically show the fastest growing wavelength versus that distance scaling factor for compressing the soil. And these are just one-dimensional and two-dimensional calculations of that, and they give pretty similar answers. Basically, the fastest growing wavelength is some, more or less grows approximately with this distance. We distribute them randomly, and it's a good question of whether that's a reasonable thing to do. And they're the voids themselves. You mean in terms of like how many voids you put in? Yeah, it does depend on that as well. And I'm not sure it's like some complicated dependence, but. So this is basically what you get out of a linear stability analysis. And what I've plotted here is basically the power spectrum of the peak of the power spectrum of the model. Basically, what is the length scale characterizing that interface after one freeze-thaw cycle. So it does a pretty good job of predicting the dependence of that, the linear stability analysis of that thing, of that size on this distance scaling factor. However, if you look at the simulation 200 cycles in and ask the question, what is the dominant, the peak wavelength of the simulation, it's basically much larger than this prediction of the linear stability analysis. I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. We're not considering kind of the actual cycle. We're just going from thawed state to thawed state. So we're not including the cycle. I'm actually going to come back to that. Doesn't seem to want to go back, but maybe. Oh wait, no. There was something I was supposed to say here, and that is that one reason that this is happening out of many is that there's actually a selection as these bumps in the interface become a finite amplitude, there's a selection against small wavelengths. And that's because if you have a really small wavelength bump in that interface, we're kind of assuming in our analysis that the freezing front is following that interface. But if you have a small bump, you have freezing in from the sides. And that basically tends to reduce this feedback for small wavelengths, but preserve it for larger wavelengths. So that's one of the reasons that you see this. Another reason, well, I won't talk about the other reason now, but if anyone wants to know, just ask me. I just want to talk about a few other features of this model and then about a thing it doesn't do. First of all, if you increase the slope in the model, so we're starting from zero slope here to a 15 degree slope here, we basically see in the model a transition to stripes, which is what's seen in nature. So that's a good sign. When we decrease the concentration of stones relative to soil, that is the thickness of the initial layer of stones relative to the initial layer of soil, what we observe is a transition from circles to mazes and then to kind of these isolated circular features of stones or islands. What we don't see in that transition is polygons. So we haven't gotten, with this model, just with the frosty, we haven't been able to get polygons to form. So it suggests that there's something else going on that's creating those polygons.
Polygons in this tight area, and the pictures of polygons you show is somewhere else.
Yeah, there are some, there's a plateau that's up and has a different kind of rock, different rock size, different hydrology, that's fairly adjacent to this that has beautifully developed polygons. They're kind of hard to photograph. So I want to just then address the question of how we can get these connected networks with a low concentration of stones. In the model I just showed you, you get islands, but how could we get polygons? So as I said, using this model, we weren't able to make any progress with that, so we decided to make a new model. So three dimensions is just too complicated, so we decided to go to two dimensions, where we would just have a surface and then stones moving around on that surface. And so basically this is kind of the concept that we have in mind for this model, where we just track how many stones are at any location within the model, and then use that as a surrogate for the depth of the stone layer there. So let me show you then in terms of what processes we put into this model. So the primary process I talked about in the last model was Frostheave. And basically, what did Frostheave do? Well, it tended to drive soil towards soil domains and drive stones towards stone domains. In this model, we're just kind of thinking about what the stones are doing. So what we're basically going to do is create a surface that the stones move on that depends on the number of stones in the local neighborhood. And so if you have lots of stones, then you depress the surface there, then that creates strong gradients which tend to tumble other stones in there. So that's basically a representation then of the feedback that I was talking about in the last model. But as I said, that feedback isn't enough to get polygons. So we had to think a lot about how would you could get polygons. And after kind of perusing the literature and trying to see what people have noted in terms of processes, it turns out that there's actually something that's very simple that's missing in the last model. And that is that if you have a well-developed stone domain and a well-developed soil domain, this lateral frost heave will coherently squeeze the stone domain as it freezes up. That squeezing, so from two sides, will tend to elevate the stone domain. And then if it's occurring preferentially at one particular place in that stone domain, the stones, thereby being elevated, will tend to tumble along the axis of the stone domain. And so basically it's a mechanism then, it's a mechanism that nobody who studies permafrost would argue with, but it's a mechanism that allows us to basically draw out stone domains into long lines. So what happens when you do that? Okay, let me just see if I can pull it up. Oops. Okay. So starting from a random configuration of stones, basically with these two mechanisms, you tend to form these lines of stones, which then form themselves into these polygonal patterns. The junctions tend to want to be at equiangular junctions. You can see a number of things going on. Small polygons tend to disappear. I'll talk about that in a second. And see if anything else is going on. There's another one.
Two dimensional soap froths.
I know it looks very similar to this.
What's interesting is it's kind of a living soap froth because you're able to create new links.
Some kind of
depression is formed and the rocks go along that depression and start to fill it out.
That's right.
Things merge and tell stuff that the angles aren't 120 degrees and they still have to.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like you don't see in soap froth the creation of a new film connecting two faces that just kind of, you know, nucleates in the background.
Right.
Because it's a finite cycle. Whether it's very thin or you have a bunch of borders.
Right.
Where they're kind of more liquid than how much liquid you have.
Right.
So, whether they're dry or they're wet.
Mm-hmm.
Four-way junctions, you mean? Or?
Well, I mean, there was a four-way junction in the animation you were just showing, and it was hard to see whether it was persistent or whether it was going to decay into two three-way junctions.
Yeah, it actually did decay into two three-way junctions. Basically, what it seems like the four-way junctions are, just to answer this question, I guess maybe I'll have it on the next slide, I'm not sure, but are basically, I'm not sure exactly why, but they seem to be unstable. And especially if there's any difference between the two angles, two sets of angles. And so I'll show in the next slide, I think, how those decay into two three-way junctions, at least in our model. The things that you saw are the smaller polygons going away and the four-way junctions decaying into three-way junctions. I don't know if you can see that, but I'll talk about it on the next slide. So basically what happens in our model is that it's the squeezing mechanism that's really the important thing. And so if you have a three-way junction where the angles aren't equal, the places where the angles are bigger have more soil, basically, and more ability to squeeze. And it elevates the stone domain here, causing the stones to tumble off in that direction and moving the junction up in that direction. For small polygons, if they're small, and for example, if they have four sides, Again, the same mechanism operates. This angle is small. All these angles are smaller than these angles, and so the junctions get pushed in towards the center, and the polygon disappears. For a four-way junction, if the angles are not equal, and perhaps this is the, even if they are approximately equal, it might be unstable. If the angles aren't equal, then the where the angles are bigger, you'll get more squeezing. That'll basically push stones off in these two directions, thereby basically tending to create two three-way junctions. So those are the kind of network processes that we can see in this model. And as you've noted, they're similar to. I'll show you in just a
second. Models is P of A versus A, and we know that's actually a transitory thing with 7 + 7 is 8.
Yeah.
What's interesting is the way.
Yeah, I'll actually have a plot of that in just a minute.
And what's interesting is that in the soap cross, that the key item is that you have to have 120 degrees at every vertex. So the boundaries are curved. And that leads to different differential pressures, which drive the cells with smaller than 6 size,
right?
The ones that are larger than 6 grow. Here you seem to have straight lines, rather than an angle constraint. But nevertheless, you seem to have some of the same dynamics,
right?
The cells with that don't have the right, don't have their fair share of size straight, and the other one grow.
Right. Okay, so I just want to kind of summarize then the discussion of this two-dimensional model that gives us polygons by noting that here's just a picture that shows this transition from polygons to islands. And as we increase the effect of this squeezing, we do see a fairly sharp transition between islands and polygons in the model. So, on a slope, you can actually see some fairly interesting patterns on a slight slope. They will be elongated, and then but they also develop through time. In some cases, I've seen basically they're elongated for a fairly long time, and then they eventually evolve into stripes. So it's the polygon is kind of like a quasi stable state.
Can you do a laboratory experiment
with this? No, you can't. Basically, the freezing, you can't obviously do it. The freezing process, the formation of ice lenses, is something that basically it's critically dependent on it occurring very slowly, and people have tried to speed it up and basically failed. And I think there's some arguments about why that is, but I'm not really sure what they are.
You can beat it up and look at the lens.
Yeah, I mean, digging in frozen ground is pretty hard, but yeah, you can definitely do it, and people do. but it's not something you're going to do a lot of. I just want to talk address the question about evaluating the model and what predictions of the model for polygons. So we calculated within our model the distribution of intersection angles, and also of areas normalized by the mean, and compared that. So the in the model that is shown in red. I'm sorry, this didn't come out very well for both plots. And then the dash line and the dot dash line, I think, are two fields of polygons that we measured in Alaska. And And at least within the variability of those two fields, we seem to get pretty good agreement.
Is there a learning in time?
You mean in model, in our model? They're fairly stable in time, yeah. I can't say for sure whether they wouldn't change, but yeah. Okay, so again, the model seems to check out, at least with what we can fairly easily measure. So to kind of, I kind of want to summarize, I'm really over on time, so I don't know, can I spend another 5 minutes or so talking?
We have talking time.
Okay, I'll try not to wait till then, but basically I want to kind of summarize what I've talked about so far, and then I don't know, you might or might not like what follows, try to put it in some context in terms of how we're thinking in general about describing and modeling landscape patterns. But just to summarize, in three dimensions, in the three-dimensional model with just the frost heave, basically, feedback, we're able to get circles, mazes, islands, and stripes. So four of the five major groups of sorted pattern ground. By adding squeezing, stone domain squeezing into a two-dimensional model, basically we're able to get to add the fifth feature. So we're able to get islands, mazes, circles, polygons, and stripes. So in some sense, we're pretty happy then that we at least have some pretty good hypothesis for what's underlying these patterns. And let me just note that in these two models, in this model, we were kind of, the variables that we were using were pretty basic or constituent level, the stones and the soil. Here we were kind of using a funny set of variables, but essentially what we were doing was looking at the concentration of stones and soil by inference. And so we were kind of using two different variable sets. We're also using two different dynamics. One, the dynamics here basically just depended on kind of the local configuration of stones and soil, their concentrations. Here, to get squeezing, we needed to really focus in on the boundaries between well-developed stone and soil domains. So in a sense, we were doing something a little bit different in these two models. So to kind of tell you a little bit about our thinking about landscape patterns and how we might think about them, how we might describe them, just noting that you can describe patterns or any system, really, with a variety of variable sets. For example, as I said, you could describe the sorted circle in terms of its stones and soil clods, or you could describe it in terms of, for example, the boundary between the stone and soil domains. The first description, you'd have a lot of degrees of freedom, a lot of variables. The second description, you'd have fewer. It might just be like nodes placed along this boundary. Then if you think a little bit about the dynamics, then, of these two variable sets, you think about taking a stone. This is a bad picture, but taking a stone and basically perturbing it, its position, rocking it out of its little pocket, it'll recover very fast. So it has a very fast recovery time. Whereas this, if you perturb this stone-soil boundary, it'll recover very slowly. This might happen in a fraction of a second. This might happen over decades. So these different descriptions have different dynamical properties. And so it's especially popular amongst ecologists, but also becoming more popular in some aspects of earth science, is to describe the system then in terms of a hierarchy of descriptions. So I could, for example, use a variable set that the stone and soil position, or the stone and soil boundary, or characteristics of the pattern, like the mean spacing or mean diameter, and basically use these variable sets then to describe the dynamics in a separate sense. Here we're describing the dynamics over fairly short time periods. Here we'd be describing the dynamics over centuries. In this hierarchy, then, the time scale increases as you go up, and the number of variables you need to describe the system decreases. One view is that basically these descriptions are redundant, descriptions of the system. But basically, I don't really think that's the case. And so another view is that that each of these descriptions is independent and adds more information to describing the dynamics of the system. So we can think of each of these as being an independent variable set with its own independent dynamics. These different levels of description then can be linked together in terms of the faster scale variables have a longer time scale expression, and those things can be linked together either in terms of thinking of this as self-organization, or that is how the feedbacks act on these faster scale variables to produce the longer scale order, or how the longer scale system provides the context for the motion of the faster scale variables. So, so kind of in summary, then, to describe this pattern ground system, then, I guess I would assert that we would need to develop models for each of these variable sets and each of these sets of dynamics. What we tend to do is describe the system in terms of its fundamental characteristics or in terms of its very basic pattern characteristics. But these intermediate descriptions of the system, which are to some extent, although what we focused on in these models, although not very well, I would say, contains a dynamics that's basically missing from these other descriptions. And so if we don't focus some of our attention, at least, on those levels of description, we're going to be missing something about the dynamics of these systems. So I'll leave it at that. Thanks for sticking around.